Fraud of Feminism by E. Belfort Bax, Part 2. An initial difficulty exists in proving theoretically the intellectual inferiority of women to men, or even their relative unsuitability for fulfilling functions involving a special order of judgment. There are such things as matters of fact, which are open to common observation, and which none think of denying or calling into question unless they have some special reason for doing so. Now, it is always possible to deny a fact, however evident it may be to ordinary perception, and it is equally impossible to prove that the person calling into question the aforesaid evident fact is either lying, or shall we say is prevaricating, or even that he is a person hopelessly abnormal in his organs of sense perception. At the time of writing, the normal person, who has no axe to grind in maintaining the contrary, declares the sun to be shining brightly. But should it answer the purpose of anyone to deny this obvious fact and declare that the day is gloomy and overcast, there is no power of argument by which I can prove that I am right and that he is wrong. I may point to the sun, but if he chooses to affirm that he does not see it, I cannot prove that he does. This is, of course, an extreme case, scarcely likely to occur in actual life, but it is, in essence, similar to those cases of persons, and they are not seldom met with, who, when they find facts hopelessly destructive of a certain theoretical position adopted by them, do not hesitate to cut the knot of controversy in their own favour by boldly denying the inconvenient facts. One often has experience of this trick of controversy in discussing the question of the notorious characteristics of the female sex. The feminist, driven into a corner, endeavours to save his face by flatly denying matters open to common observation and admitted as obvious by all who are not feminists. Such facts are the pathological mental condition peculiar to the female sex, commonly connoted by the term hysteria, the absence, or at best, the extremely imperfect development of the logical faculty in most women, the inability of the average woman in her judgment of things to rise above personal considerations, and, what is largely a consequence of this, the lack of a sense of abstract justice and fair play among women in general. The aforesaid peculiarities of women, as women are, I contend, matters of common observation, and are only disputed by those persons, to wit, feminists, to whose theoretical views and practical demands their admission would be inconvenient, if not fatal. Of course, these characterizations refer to averages, and they do not exclude partial or even occasionally striking exceptions. It is possible, therefore, although perhaps not very probable, that individual experience may, in the case of certain individuals, play a part in falsifying their general outlook. It is possible, although, as I before said, not perhaps very probable, that any given man's experience of the other sex has been limited to a few quite exceptional women, and that hence his particular experience contradicts that of the general run of mankind. In this case, of course, his refusal to admit what to others are self-evident facts would be perfectly bona fide. The above highly improbable contingency is the only refuge for those who would contend for sincerity in the feminists' denials. In this matter, I only deal with the male feminist. The female feminist is usually too biased a witness in this particular question. Now let us consider the whole of the differentiations of the mental character between man and woman in the light of a further generalization, which is sufficiently obvious in itself and which has been formulated with exceptional clearness by the late Otto Weininger in his remarkable book Geschlecht und Charakter, Sex and Character. I refer to the observations contained in section 2, chapters 2 and 3. The point has been, of course, previously noted, and the present writer, among others, has on various occasions called special attention to it, but its formulation and elaboration by Weininger is the most complete that I know of. The truth in question consists in the fact, undeniable to all those not rendered impervious to facts by preconceived dogma, that, as I have elsewhere put it, while man has a sex, woman is a sex. Let us hear Weininger on this point. Quote, "Woman is only sexual. Man is also sexual. Alike in time and space, this difference may be traced in man. Parts of his body susceptible to sexual excitement are small in number and strictly localized. In woman, sexuality is diffused over the whole body. Every contact on whatever part excites her sexually." Close quote. Weininger points out that while the sexual element in man, owing to the physiological character of the sexual organs, may be at times more violent than that in woman, yet that it is spasmodic and occurs in crises separated by intervals of quiescence. In woman, on the other hand, while less spasmodic, it is continuous. The sexual instinct with man being, as he styles it, an appendix, and no more, he can raise himself mentally entirely outside of it. Quote, "He is conscious of it as of something which he possesses, but which is not inseparate from the rest of his nature. He can view it objectively. With woman, this is not the case. The sex element is part of her whole nature. Hence, it is not, as with man, clearly recognizable in local manifestations, but subtly affects the whole life of the organism. For this reason, the man is conscious of the sexual element within him as such, whereas the woman is unconscious of it as such. It is not for nothing that in common parlance woman is spoken of as the sex. In this sexual differentiation of the whole life nature of woman from man, deducible as it is from physiological and anatomical distinctions, lies the ground of those differentiations of function, which culminate in the fact that while mankind, in its intellectual, moral, and technical development, is represented in the main by man, woman has continued to find her chief function in the direct procreation of the race." Close quote. A variety of causes, notably a modern economic development, in their effect on family life, also the illegitimate application of the modern democratic notion of the equality of classes and races to that of sex, has contributed to the modern revolt against natural sex limitations. Assuming a substantial accuracy of the above statement of fact, the absurdity and cheapness of the claptrap of the modern social purity monger as to having one and the same sexual morality for both sexes will be readily seen. The recognition of the necessity of admitting greater latitude in this respect to men than to women is based clearly on physiology and common sense. With men, sexual instinct manifests itself locally, and at intervals its satisfaction is an urgent and pressing need. With woman, this is not so. Hence, the recognized distinction between the sexes in this respect is, as far as it goes, a thoroughly sound one. Not that I am championing the severity of the restrictions of the current sexual code as regards women. On the contrary, I think it ought to be, and will be, in a reasonable society of the future, considerably relaxed. I am only pointing out that the urgency is not so great in the one case as it is in the other. And this fact, it is, which has led to the toleration of astringency, originally arising mainly from economic causes, questions of inheritance and the like, in the case of women, which would not have been tolerated in that of men, even had similar reasons for its adoption in their case obtained. Any successful attempt of social purity mongers to run counter to physiology in enforcing either by legislation or public opinion the same stringency on men in this respect as on women could but have the most disastrous consequences to the health and well-being of the community.
Tune in to Radio Stormer on thedailystormer.com.
It was a saying of the late Dr. Henry Maudsley that sex lies deeper than culture. By this, we may understand to be meant that sex differences are organic. All authorities on the physiological question are agreed that woman is less well organized, less well developed than man. Dr. Deverini asserts that this fact is traceable throughout the whole female organism, throughout all its tissues and all its functions. For instance, the stature of the human female is less than that of the man in all races. As regards weight, there is a corresponding difference. The adult woman weighs on the average rather more than 11 pounds less than the man. Moreover, as a rule, a woman completes her growth some years earlier than a man. The bones are lighter in the woman than in the man, not absolutely, but in proportion to the weight of the body. They are, it is stated, not merely thinner, but more fragile. The difference may be traced even to their chemical composition. The whole muscular development is inferior in woman to that in man by about one third. The heart in woman is smaller and lighter than in man, being about 10.5 ounces in man as against slightly over 8 ounces in woman. In the woman, the respiratory organs show less chest and lung capacity. Again, the blood contains a considerably less proportion of red to white corpuscles. Finally, we come to the question of the size and constitution of the brain. It should be observed that all these distinctions of sex show themselves more or less from birth onwards. Specialists are agreed that at all ages the size of the brain of the woman is less than that of the man. The difference in a relative size is greater in proportion according to the degree of civilization. This is noteworthy, as it would seem as though the brain of man grew with the progress of civilization, whereas that of woman remains nearly stationary. The average proportion as regards size of skull between the woman and the man of today is as 85 to 100. The weight of brain in woman varies from 38.5 ounces to 45.5 ounces, in man from 42 ounces to 49 ounces. This represents the absolute difference in weight, but according to Dr. Deverini, the relative weight, or the weight in proportion to that of the whole body, is even more striking in its indication of inferiority. The weight of the brain in woman is but 1/44 of the weight of the body, while in man it is 1/40. This difference accentuates itself with age. It is only 7% in favour of man between 20 and 30 years. It is 11% between 30 and 40 years. As regards the substance of the brain itself and its convolutions, the enormous majority of physiologists are practically unanimous in declaring that the female brain is simpler and smoother, its convolutions fewer and more superficial than those of the male brain, that the frontal lobes, generally associated with the intellectual faculties, are less developed than the occipital lobes, which are universally connected with the lower psychological functions. the grey substance, is poorer and less abundant in woman than in man, while the blood vessels of the occipital region are correspondingly fuller than those supplying the frontal lobes. In man, the case is exactly the reverse. It cannot be denied by any sane person familiar with the barest elements of physiology that the entire female organism is subservient to the functions of childbearing and lactation, which explains the inferior development of those organs and faculties which are not specifically connected with this supreme end of woman. It is the fashion of the feminists, ignoring these fundamental physiological sex differences, to affirm that the actual inferiority of women, where they have the honesty to admit such an obvious fact, is accountable by the centuries of oppression in which woman has been held by wicked and evil-minded man. The absurdity of this contention has been more than once pointed out. Assuming its foundation in fact, what does it imply? Clearly, that the girls inherit only through their mothers, and boys only through their fathers, a hypothesis plainly at variance with the known facts of heredity. Yet those who maintain that distinction of intelligence between the sexes is traceable to external conditions affecting one sex only and inherited through that sex alone cannot evade the above assumption. Those, therefore, who regard it as an article of their faith that a woman should show herself not inferior in mental power to man if only she had the chance of exercising that power, must find a surer foundation for their opinion than this theory of the centuries of oppression under which, as they allege, the female sex has laboured. We now come to the important question of morbid and pathological mental conditions to which the female sex is liable and which are usually connected with those constitutional disturbances of the nervous system which pass under the name of hysteria. The word is, as everyone knows, derived from hystera, the womb, and was uniformly regarded by the ancients as directly due to disease of the uterus, this view maintaining itself in modern medicine up till well nigh the middle of the 19th century. Thus, Dr. J. Mason Good, in his Study of Medicine, an important medical textbook during the earlier half of the 19th century, says, quote, "With a morbid condition of this organ, hysteria is, in many instances, very closely connected, though it is going too far to say that it is always dependent upon such condition, for we meet with instances, occasionally, in which no possible connection can be traced between the disease and the organ." Close quote. This is perhaps the first appearance, certainly in English medicine, of doubts being thrown on the uterine origin of the various symptoms grouped under the general term hysteria. Towards the latter part of the 19th century, the prevalent view tended more and more to disassociate hysteria from uterine trouble. Lately, however, some eminent pathologists have shown a tendency to qualify the terms of the latter view. Thus, Dr. Thomas Stevenson, in 1902, admits that it, hysteria, frequently accompanies a morbid state of the uterus, especially where inflammation and congestion are present, and it is not an uncommon thing for surgeons at the present time to remove the ovaries in obstinate cases of hysteria. On the other hand, Dr. Thomas Buzzard, in an article on the subject in Kane's Dictionary of Medicine, 1902, states that hysteria is only exceptionally found in women suffering from diseases of the genital organs, and its relation to uterine and ovarian disturbances is probably neither more nor less than that which pertains to the other affections of the nervous system, which may occur without any obvious material cause. Dr. Thomas Luff, Textbook on Forensic Medicine, 1895, shows that the derangements of the reproductive functions are undoubtedly the cause of various attacks of insanity in the female. Dr. Savage, in his book on neuroses, says that acute mania in women occurs most frequently at the period of adult and mature life and may occasionally take place at either extreme age. Acute mania sometimes occurs at the suppression of the menses. The same is true of melancholia and other pathological mental symptoms. Dr. Luff states that acute mania may replace hysteria, that this happens at periods such as puberty, change of life, and menstruation. These patients, in the intervals of their attacks, are often morbidly irritable or excitable, but as time goes on, their energies become diminished and their emotions blunted. Such patients are often seized with a desire to commit violence. They are often very mischievous, tearing up clothes, breaking windows, etc. In this mental disorder, the patient is driven by a morbid and uncontrollable impulse to such acts. It is not accompanied by delusions, and frequently no change will have been noticed in the individual prior to the commission of the act, and consequently, says Dr. Love, there is much difference of opinion as to the responsibility of the individual. Among the acts spoken of, Dr. Luff mentions a propensity to set fire to furniture, houses, etc. All this, although written in 1895, might serve as a commentary on the suffragette agitation of recent years. The renowned French professor, Dr. Paul Janet, in his Les Hystériques, 1894, thus defined hysteria. Quote, "Hysteria is a mental affection belonging to the large group of diseases due to cerebral weakness and debility. Its physical symptoms are somewhat indefinite, consisting chiefly in a general diminution of nutrition. It is largely characterized by moral symptoms, chief of which is an impairment of the faculty of psychological synthesis, an abolition and a contraction of the field of consciousness. This manifests itself in a peculiar manner and by a certain number of elementary phenomena. Thus, sensations and images are no longer perceived and appear to be blotted out from the individual perception, a tendency which results in their persistent and complete separation from the personality in some cases, and in the formation of many independent groups. This series of psychological facts alternate the one with the other, or coexist. Finally, this synthetic defect favours the formation of certain independent ideas, which develop complete in themselves, and unattached from the control of the consciousness of the personality. These ideas show themselves in affections, possessing very various and unique characteristics." Close quote. According to Mr. A. S. Millar, FRCSE, Encyclopedia Medica, Volume 5, quote, "Hysteria is that condition in which there is imagination, imitation, or exaggeration. It occurs mostly in females and persons of nervous temperament, and is due to some nervous derangement, which may or may not be pathological." Close quote. Sir James Paget, in his Clinical Lectures on Mimicry, says also that hysterical patients are mostly females of nervous temperament. Quote, "They think of themselves constantly, are fond of telling everyone of their troubles, and thus court sympathy, for which they have a morbid craving. Willpower is deficient in one direction, though some have it very strongly where their interests are concerned." Close quote. He thinks the term hysteria in the sense now employed is incorrect and would substitute mimicry. "The will should be controlled by the intellect," observes Dr. G. F. Still of King's College Hospital, "rather than by the emotions, and the lack of this control appears to be at the root of some, at least, of the manifestations of hysteria."
You're tuned in to Radio Stormer on the Daily Stormer.com.
Dr. Thomas Buzzard previously mentioned thus summarizes the mental symptoms, quote, "The intelligence may be apparently of good quality, the patient evincing sometimes a remarkable quickness of apprehension, but carefully tested it is found to be wanting in the essentials of the highest class of mental power. The memory may be good, but the judgment is weak, and the ability to concentrate the attention for any length of time upon a subject is absent. So also regard for accuracy and the energy necessary to ensure it in any work that is undertaken is deficient. The emotions are excited with undue readiness and when aroused are incapable of control. Tears are occasioned not only by pathetic ideas but by ridiculous subjects, and peals of laughter may incongruously greet some tragic announcement, or the converse may take place. The ordinary signs of emotion may be absent and replaced by an attack of syncope, convulsion, pain, or paralysis. Perhaps more constant than any other phenomenon in hysteria is a pronounced desire for the sympathy and interest of others. This is evidently only one of the most characteristic qualities of femininity, uncontrolled by the action of the higher nervous centres, which in a healthy state keep it in subjection. There is very frequently not only a deficient regard for truthfulness, but a proneness to active deception and dishonesty. So common is this that the various phases of hysteria are often assumed to be simple examples of voluntary simulation, and the title of the disease refused to the condition. But it seems more reasonable to refer the symptoms to impairment of the highly complex nervous processes, which form the physiological side of the moral faculties." Close quote. Kane's Dictionary of Medicine, 1902. Quote, "It is not uncommon to find hysteria in females accompanied by an utter indifference and insensibility to sexual relations. Premature cessation of ovulation is a frequent determining cause. In cases where the ovaries are absent, the change from girl to woman, which normally takes place at puberty, does not occur. The girl grows, but does not develop. A masculine appearance supervenes. The voice becomes manly and harsh. Sexual passion is absent, but the health remains good. The most violent instances of hysteria are in young women of the most robust and masculine constitution." Close quote. John Mason Good, M.D., The Study of Medicine, 1822. Other determining causes are given, as painful impressions, long fasting, strong emotions, imitation, luxury, ill-directed education and unhappy surroundings, celibacy, where not of choice, but enforced by circumstances, unfortunate marriages, long-continued trouble, fright, worry, overwork, disappointment, and such like nervous perturbations, all which causes predispose to hysteria. It attacks childless women more frequently than mothers, and particularly young widows, and, says Dr. J. Mason Good, more especially still, those who are constitutionally inclined to that morbid salacity which has often been called nymphomania, the surest remedy of which is a happy marriage. And that's from the Study of Medicine from 1822. Hysteria is, in common with other nervous disorders, essentially a hereditary malady, and Briquet gives statistics to show that in 9 cases out of 10, hysterical parents have hysterical children.